Fork Tales, a podcast that feeds the food and beverage world. Fork Tales is brought to you by Pavone Group and Vigor, a branding and marketing agency for restaurant, beverage, and hospitality brands. Learn more at vigorbranding.com. If you love what we're serving up, please give Fork Tales a 5-star review on your podcast service of choice. Think of it as a tip for good service.
My next thing is, I did not know this, but the I in Unite stands for invite. And I did not realize on the back of every bar, there's an email address that people can send directly to you for suggestions on new flavors. Have you learned anything from these? Have you gotten anything interesting in the emails?
Yes, I love those emails. Like, those emails come to me. And so I get to interact with the people that write those emails. And, you know, the most meaningful ones are when people will give me a flavor suggestion, but then they'll also say, thank you for making a bar for us. You know, thank you. And it's exactly what I wanted
That's
to
super
do
cool.
when I set out was like, make the invisible feel seen. And, you know, I know what it's like to not feel seen. You know, I know what it's like to like kind of be in the shadows, like being a woman in the plumbing industry, perfect example, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you don't really belong here, or you don't, like, you know, somebody that looks like me typically doesn't work in plumbing, right? Like, it's a very old, you know, antiquated kind of industry. And so, like, when I get those emails, I get really excited, and people do have some great ideas and ideas of like things that we've actually developed, you know, and just haven't launched. And, you know, so it's fun to know that like it is also on trend for people.
And you mentioned family businesses and challenges in the same sentence there. So, and that's typically what people talk about, family businesses, challenges. And, you know, there are challenges in any business. But there's a lot more positives. And I'm fortunate right now. I work with my two brothers, and Brooks and Mark, which is great. We've got a great relationship both in the business and outside the business. So I love it. And, you know, when you talk about the challenges, there's challenges. And I'm not going to dive into all those because people in family business understand those. But
yeah.
But there's so many positives,
yeah.
And especially in at some point, I'm sure we'll talk about COVID, only because COVID and the restaurant business was a difficult time. But, you know, in COVID, it was really nice having family there dealing with what we went through in every business. I mean, that was the one thing that you really needed, people that you trusted and respected and in many cases loved to be there by your side as you're navigating something like that, which is hopefully we never see anything like that again. So that's really some of the positives.
And I just said, hold on. Can we take organic lemon water and make it taste good? And that was really the seat of the journey. I didn't run out of the locker room that day and go start a beverage company. We ended up losing to Iowa State in the first round of the NCAA tournament in Milwaukee. The next week I was in Los Angeles. I was having lunch with a friend to invest. He's an angel investor in a lot of consumer businesses. And I said, John, what do you think about this idea? And he said, I love it. Anything that you can do, that you can build, that captures a piece of someone's daily routine, right? What they do in the morning when they first get up, what they do at night when they go to sleep, or any point in between is worth going for. You can build a business around. And I jumped up. I said, you know what? The hell with it. I'm going to take a year off and go see what we can do. You know, I don't know if that was a good decision or a bad decision. Time will tell. But 7 years later, I've had a lot of fun. We've sold over 100 million bottles.
Wow.
And, you know, Michael, we feel like we're just getting started.
So every time I see a woman, you know, every time I see a woman on the Food Network, or, you know, I see, you know, just something in the news about, you know, a woman taking over a new position. I think that that's breaking a barrier. It's showing that we can do it too.
As you scale a restaurant brand, you lose the scrappy mindset. You lose so much. So I think the most important advice is, don't wait till you have everything before you test that thesis. And having a similar mindset to tech companies, it's like, get an MVP out. Get this. What is the least you can do to go test your idea? Because the best restaurants are brands that are built over a period of time.
If you're not excited about it, you're probably not going to have the energy to push through those sideways moments. You know, and Do you think that there's just a little bit of a risk-taking nature to some people? You know, I was prepared to lose it all if it didn't work out. Mm-hmm. I'm like, all right, well, we'll just start again. And, you know.
Well, when I started, I had nothing. I really didn't have anything to lose. I wasn't married. I didn't have any kids. I had $300 on my checking account. That's the truth. I just was like, $300, you know, whatever, you know, I'll get a job if I have to. So I really, you know, so I didn't really have the capital. But there was things that were along the way, though. The bigger risks I took were later on when you actually have something to lose. That's when you have a risk. So,
you know, more times than I can count, honestly, times when I thought, like, how will we get this funding? How are we going to make payroll? Times when I thought, like, how will we ever be able to produce this much? Times when I thought, like, how will we ever compete with these massive brands at the shelf? Like, COVID happening, supply chain challenges happening. It feels like a game of whack-a-mole. It's like you think you got one thing covered and then, oh, tariffs, or it's something every week there's a new adventure. And for me, I think the thing that keeps me going really is my daughter. Like, I think knowing that I'm doing this for a reason much bigger than, oh, I want to get rich or be an entrepreneur, like having her as my North Star. And then kind of as I've been on this journey and have been fortunate enough to be a mentor to other women founders and to other minority founders, like seeing that I get this like privilege, honestly, to be able to help pave the way for other companies. Like, I don't take that lightly. And I think it's important that I do everything in my power to try to make this business successful, not just for myself, but for my family and for other entrepreneurs that will hopefully do what I'm doing, but go further and go faster.
I have so many friends going to Korea now as tourists. That never happened when I was growing up. Like, I have like, everyone is like, going to Korea. I'm going to Korea. I'm bringing my daughter. They're all bringing their kids because their kids are obsessed. Obsessed. Mm-hmm. It's like young teenagers, 20-something year olds, all obsessed with going to Korea. They all want to, you know, like eat the food, everything. So it's amazing for me, especially because I've gone from being embarrassed about my lunchbox at school and one generation to like everybody like spamming me like, what are they eating in this? What are they drinking? What is that? And da-da-da. And, you know, and people, and just the curiosity around Korean food. It's like this cultural voyeurism, you know, and just having to like explain things. I guess it's like demystifying Korean cuisine for the masses.
As we know that there's massive food waste going on in the United States, where a lot of products are still completely fine to eat, yet maybe they are visibly looking perfect, so they're tossed out and not used. That's just one example. There's a lot of different examples.
Sure.
So trying to find ways as a brand where you can take these imperfect ingredients and instead of them being thrown out, you can actually use them. Mm-hmm. So when we were creating the dill pickle flavor, we just were like, wow, we need something to be a little bit more innovative. It's not, this recipe is not perfected yet. Mm-hmm. And when Cleveland Kitchen out of Ohio, the founders told us that they cut off the pickle ends and throw them out, that's when a light bulb went off. And I was like, oh my gosh, like we're throwing away tons of pickle ends a year that we can incorporate into our pickle paste. So that's exactly what we did.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it takes time to overcome stigmas and preconceptions and whatnot. I think one of the reasons I was sort of cut out for maybe this role was because ever since I was a little kid, my father never hid his cannabis use to me. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even when I was 9 years old, he'd be like, hey, Kenny, I'm going to go get some grass. You want to come with me? And I would go with him to his dealer, who was a buddy. And I was, you know, ever the entrepreneur. I was 9 years old selling magazine subscriptions like we all did at, you know, elementary school back in the day. And he'd be weighing out my dad's eighth on the scale. And I'd say, hey, Vic, do you want to buy a magazine subscription? And, you know,
that's
my
awesome.
Dad was... My dad was buying something off him and he was buying something off me. So
ugly food is a thing. I mean, we're one of the largest suppliers of applesauce in America. You know, apples, the pretty apples are going to your local grocers. Sometimes the imperfect ones aren't. And if we can grab those and process those into correctional applesauce, that's a win for everybody. You know, I'm shocked at the amount of fruit that is shaken to the ground in America still to this day. And there's still homeless and hungry people in America. Whatever we can do to bridge that gap and take food that's, you know, being produced and get it to the end users is what we need to do.
I don't think a mentor has to be a woman. I think it can be somebody that wants to listen or somebody that's able to listen. I had somebody say to me once, the best male mentor is somebody that has a daughter. Because I think that's a man that really wants to see women go far as well, because they want their daughter to be there as well.
When you have a group of 60 people with families and mm-hmm. this is, I mean, listen, Lemon Perfect is not a 9-to-5, right? So our people right. are really invested in what we're doing. I think if you spend some time here, you'd say, my God, they're irrationally invested in what Lemon Perfect can become. They bleed yellow. We talk about that a lot.
It's awesome.
I do think we've got good balance here, but when we're on, we're on. And there's no other way to scale a business like this than to have that irrational, enthusiasm for where we can take this business.
It is a all-consuming, up and down roller coaster kind of journey. And, you know, if you have a problem that's keeping you up at night that you want to solve for a reason that's bigger than yourself, then like I say, go for it. And it's okay to start small. And it's important to ask for help. I think, that's a muscle that I've had to learn how to strengthen over time. And it's been so inspiring to see how warm and inclusive this industry is. I feel like there's been so many things that I felt like were existential crises, and I would call someone, and none of this is like rocket science. Like most mm-hmm. of the challenges that we're facing are things that other companies and other people have been through. And so being able to ask for help, being willing to start small and be humble in how you go about building your business, but knowing that it's a challenging road even for the best of us.
For me, it was all about aligning the business to be customer focused, because my thesis was, if you focus on your customers, they will reward you with loyalty. And if they reward you with loyalty, your revenue will grow, right? It's a win-win. Mm-hmm. If you create value, why would somebody leave you? So it's when you're not creating value and you're creating problems for the customer that, you know, you have that attrition. And so for me, it was really about making sure that we were taking care of our customers. And that was the winning strategy. I mean, it sounds really simple, but it's way harder to execute.
As mentioned earlier, like the breadth of skill set needed to be successful is so wide. And it's like, you can have great food, but if you don't build an emotional connection to the guest, well, there's a lot of places you can get great food, right? There's a lot mm-hmm. of reason why you see hotel developers, you know, open up a hotel, and yeah, they might spend a lot of room on the dining room, but there's not a ton of authenticity or local connection. And so it's not really relatable to the community. So I think that was a really, really painful lesson early on. And I think last night was just a good reminder of like, you got to keep asking for that feedback, and you got to start, just because you develop such a deep love for how a space feels and the artwork and the story you're trying to tell, doesn't necessarily mean the community will.
I don't want to claim to be any marketing genius. And, you know, a lot of people, you know, are impressing upon us at all the times that we should really pay a lot of attention to consumer segmentation. And in cannabis, a lot is just done on hunches,
sure,
and guesses, right? We haven't had access to a lot of traditional data. And because I'm a surfer and, you know, because of my lifestyle, I just kind of feel like I've positioned the brand to almost be the Corona of cannabis.
Yeah.
Right.
Perfect.
Find your beach, yeah. You know,
yep.
A laid back, you know,
it.
Lifestyle.
I have a 21-year-old daughter and a 19-year-old son. They look at labels. I mean, this is a different, when I was a kid, I didn't know what a nutritional label was or a calorie. And I, right. you know, until probably college, I finally figured out what a calorie was. That is not the way it is anymore. You have right. young kids. We go and we watch kids all the time in school doing food testing and taking our products off the line. They're looking at the ingredients. They're looking at the label. They are informed consumers. We've been at food cuttings and, you know, we're using different things for coloring now. We're using beet extract, cherries in some cases to get reds in products and pinks and mm-hmm. in other products. We're using roots to try to get blues and in other products. They're looking at it and they're saying there's beet in this product. And I'm like, try it first before we judge, like, let's try it. And they try it, like, it's really good. So they're, I mean, the consumer is so much more educated now at a such younger age.
Well, some of the biggest surprises is when I get people from my past life of advertising email me on like LinkedIn and just tell me how they've seen me in Wegmans or wherever else and how they're just rooting for me from the guideline, you know, from the sidelines. But for me, the biggest surprises are when I actually see the brand in the wild of like somebody buying it. That for me is always the biggest surprise and like just the best feeling.
Yeah. So the Smiley Cookie started, actually my father grew up in a town called Titusville, Pennsylvania, which is a couple hours north of Pittsburgh. And actually where oil was found in the United States, ironically, 260 plus years ago at this point. And he, every single day on his way home from school, he'd walk a couple blocks, he'd have a nickel, and he'd stop into a place called Warner's Bakery and buy a cookie. Happened to have a smile on it. And so when he actually came back, moved to Pittsburgh, obviously started working for Eaton Park. And when he bought the company, he always thought back of that pleasant experience because that was that one piece each and every day. Now, maybe school, some days school was good, some days it wasn't, but that was always the piece that put a smile on his face, buying that cookie on his way home.
Roof was falling in, dirt floors, you know. But on the other side, not to go to the business side of it, but, you know, we were in an environment where you could borrow money at 4%, 3.75. Right. So money was really cheap at the moment. And I'm like, all right, let's do it. I remember driving my wife around the building, you know, a couple days later, thinking that she would smack me upside the head and say,
talk you out of it, right?
Talk me out of it. And I said, well, let's drive down at night and let's get a real head check on this thing. And we drove down and it just had a charm to it. And she's like, you should do it. Go for it.
Korean fried chicken is a separate thing. As you know, it's different than Southern Fried Chicken, Nashville Fried Chicken, Dave's Hot Chicken, all of that other stuff, Popeyes, Chick-fil-A, and that. It's a twice fried product. So it's also thin and crispy and usually it's a wet batter. So fried chicken came over to Korea with the GI presence, you know, from the war. It's not something that was traditionally Korean. It was loved by the locals. It stuck like a vengeance. It evolved and it changed. And I tend to feel that the influence of tempura, you know, of the frying of that wet batter came in to as a thinner crust, light and crispy, but like very, very like kind of like almost like a shatter crust. And so like Koreans like things that are extra crunchy, right? And so it's also been nicknamed like stained glass chicken or like eggshell chicken or something because you're looking for that crispy crunch.